Okay, you had to come a long way, Mr. Tony Arcabaggio. Welcome to Utility Function. Now I'm lucky I get to speak with you here today. It's, you know, we do work very close to each other, and I feel really lucky for that. And I would have never guessed that that would have happened until our good friend sitting over there in the corner, James Williams,
hello,
brought us together. But yeah, Tony, your background is amazing, and I'd love to hear how you ended up working with us, but we'll put that off for a bit. You know, I you've listened to the podcast before, right, Tony?
Yeah.
And we always talk about, you know, mentors, influences, how we got there. I've heard, you know, from you about your background some, but just talk to me a little bit about what life was like when you started what was really, you know, this amazing career in New York, maybe back in the late 80s, early 90s.
I think the first thing, I should start from where I was born.
And that was before the 90s.
That was before the 90s.
All right.
1970, but in Astoria, Queens. And then when I first started going to school, so like 5 or 6, we moved out to Long Island, Nassau County. And from there, I had a chance when I went to college, well, first of all, I wasn't going to leave home. I'm a nice little Italian boy. So I had to stay close to my mom and dad. And so I decided to go back to Queens, St. John's University. It was like how I just rapped before. Remember what?
Yeah, feel free to do that again.
No,
come on.
No, because you know what it was? It was because Run DMC and Sucker MC.
Yeah, yeah.
They DMC said that, you know, he was in the place to be, and he went to St. John's University, and that's where I wanted to go. So I ended up going there.
What were you studying over there?
I was a finance major. I was a finance major because I saw Wall Street, the movie, and I said, that's what I want to do. And then when I was in St. John's with, you know, in it's predominantly Italian and mostly Guido, I had all my friends there, and a lot of these guys were leaving school to become brokers. Like, you didn't have to go to school to be a broker, you know, and these guys were making mad money. And I was like, what am I doing here? I'm sitting here. I'm going to take 4 years of college, like 3 years bogged down with finance courses, which were like crazy math and formulatic things, whatever. And I was like, I'm like, this is crazy. I'm like, I don't need to go to school for this. These guys are already making money, and they like dropped out of school. So I was like, you know what? I'm here. I got to finish. I'm actually going to try to get into like advertising, art or something, because I always loved art, you know? And there was nothing that existed like that in St. John's at the time. So I ended up getting into marketing.
Yeah, but when was it that you worked for Jordan? Tell us this about this.
Well, that was when I got out of college. You know, when I got out of college with my marketing degree, and I went out into the job world to try to find something good, a career, I was being offered like $17,000 a year to be a telemarketer or some shit like that. Like, there was nothing out there. I wasn't finding anything. And at the time, I was dancing. I was dancing.
No way.
Yeah, I danced all through college.
What kind of dancing?
I bar mitzvahs, sweet 16s, weddings. Like, I was an entertainment dancer. And basically,
what the hell does that mean?
That means like, okay.
He was the entertainment. Like, they'd show up with all the boys, like doing all that crazy, like dancing for all like the young girls. But you had your clothes on and stuff.
No, I had my clothes on. I actually wore a tuxedo. And I'd break dance for little Josh at his bar mitzvah. And then I'd do a little salsa with mom, and then a little ballroom with grandma. You know, like it was.
they paid you for that?
I got paid great. And that's why I did it all through college. And then for the next 4 years, when I was out of college, I didn't even have a job. I just worked on the weekends. One day I'm sitting in my friend's basement. We're watching football, Sunday football. And my friend's girlfriend was the one woman broker that worked for Jordan. at Stratton Oakmont, which was his firm. And she was like, Tone, you'd make a great broker. And she looked at my best friend who she was dating, and she was like, come on, you got to let me have Tony, have Tony come and let him work for me and blah, blah, blah. And she started showing me her checks, 90 grand a month. You know, this is like, you know, 30 years ago, whatever, 20 something years ago.
And back when 90 grand a month meant something.
No, I mean, it still does mean something, but like, imagine then, imagine then. So that was why I said that, you know, so I was like, okay, I'm sold. I'm coming. And I went there and I spent the whole summer there and I hated it. So one day I just got up and I was like, I'm fucking out. I said, oh, I have to go help my father work at the pizzeria. He asked me, he needs me. I got to go.
Yeah. So for the move from Wall Street to Dad's pizzeria.
No. I just went back to, I think I was still dancing on the weekends then. I was because then I started looking for a job in the fashion world. And then that's
right. When so, I started you know, you told city. Me something, in the car the other night, we were going under the underpass where the train goes, where the elevated train in Brooklyn. You were talking about, you know, when you were a kid, and it seemed like your interest in art and design and the idea of what, you know, what a city and engagement should be like started when you were much, much younger. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think I remember exactly what you're talking about because we passed when we moved to Brooklyn, where my kids were born, and it was right outside our window was the elevated train. And that's how I grew up. And when I was in Astoria, right outside my window was the train. And I was in a store with my mom, she was buying shoes for my brother. And in Astoria, it was the R train, and the last stop is this 5-story elevated train. And it would sit there for a couple of minutes and then go back. That was the last stop. Well, I ended up leaving the store because I used to love to hide on my mom, and she thought I was just hiding in one of the clothing racks. I left the store, walked 2 blocks down. Now I'm about 3 in a snowsuit, like, walked away, walked down the block. My mom came out looking for me. She doesn't know where I am. I'm not in the store. She's beating my brother up, saying, where's your brother? Like, you know, everybody, it's chaos. She sees a crowd of people down the block. She runs down the block. She thinks like I got hit by a car, and it wasn't me. And then she realizes, she remembered how much I loved the trains. So she went up these two huge, you know how like Smith and Ninth, how you have that massive walk up those flights and things? I climbed all the way up there, went underneath the turnstiles, past the guy in the booth, went up there. My mom had a funny feeling, and she went all the way up and looked in the train because the doors stay open for about like 5 minutes. She looked in the train, and I was sitting on it, and I was like, going bye-bye, mom, swinging my feet. My feet didn't even touch the floor. I fucking went on the train, and I would have been in Coney Island or wherever the fuck it went.
Well,
needless to say, then I got beat up.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was that.
But I'm trying to picture how you end up being kind of icon on the Lower East Side. And what I got out of that story was you were talking about seeing graffiti and like what that was. And if that time period. I mean, when I think about graffiti on subway trains, I always think about Saturday Night Fever when he's riding. I'm like, man, what I show that to my kids and say, look at how the world has changed since then when they started cleaning stuff up.
It's a great visual though, right?
So much better. Yeah.
No, I know. But, I mean, it was dirty and grimy, but I mean, that's what the city was.
No, that's
right?
What I'm talking about. I actually think it was. So you said that was, you know, you saw that and you grabbed a spray can.
Well, you know, now as a teen, I was in Long Island where there was no graffiti, you know, but all my cousins and everybody else in my family, like I'm first generation here. So all my aunts, uncles, everybody, they were all in Jackson Heights and Astoria. And we were the only ones that really moved out to Long Island. So every weekend I'd go back to Queens to hang out with my cousins. And that's when, as a teen, that's when I really started to love it. You know, my cousins taught me how to make a marker from ripping apart school chalkboard erasers and creating markers that you couldn't buy in stores because these were super fat. Like, you know, all these little tricks and trades and
shoe polish.
Old roll-ons with the balls. You cut off the balls, the old roll-ons, and then then turn those into markers. Like we used to hand make our tools, and I just loved everything about that. You know,
I mean, I think. Not to go on to it forever, and you can speak to it, Jim, if you want, or Tony, but I don't think a lot of us understand what that was, like graffiti art, the culture, what that was like. It didn't really exist before that era, and it sort of does now, but in a way that it's already high art, in a way.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, it was a fame game, you know, but it wasn't even for everybody else. You know, it was really for other graffiti writers, you know, like, because half the time regular people couldn't even read the shit. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't like and I don't think that a lot of us cared if anybody outside of the game cared about it. You know, it was for us, you know, and I don't want to get shit twisted. Like, I wasn't this crazy train bombing guy. Like, I was a decade late for that. I was able to catch a train or two, you know, like at the tail end of when trains were still getting bombed. But, you know, for me, I was more street, highway, stuff like that, you know, but.
What was the risk associated with that time?
But there was this like mutual, so there's like the danger involved, like how high can you go? Like, but who's getting this billboard, who's hanging off the side of a building, who turned her fire extinguisher into something. But then there was like the notebooks and that you share and how you communicated with each other too, by seeing who was in whose book. Like, kind of fame too.
Yeah. You passed it around, you know, it was another way of getting up, you know, these books would travel to other boroughs and things and get filled up. And sometimes you get them back. Sometimes you wouldn't get them back. You know, again, I was, you know, spending my teen years in Long Island. So I didn't really get to really be immersed in it as much. You know, what happened was with me, I got to love it again once I started my brand, because we based it around that lifestyle. Right. You know,
I didn't go there. Like, there was... Yeah, I was going to go to the idea of you weren't thinking of, you know, graffiti as you would even mention market. You were about to talk about getting into marketing, and you didn't think of it as an art market for graffiti necessarily back then. But, you know, we'll talk to Jimmy a bit later about that too. What is considered a market for art versus just playing around and, you know, speaking to each other versus a larger group. But Talk about how A Life started. Talk about how you got back into the city out of Long Island.
And that was it. Once my stockbroking days were done, which was pretty quick, I started looking around. And I never forget one of my good friends, Vinny, who actually I used to work with in the entertainment company. He used to be the DJ and I was the dancer. One day he called me up and he was like, I'm in the city. I'm in this office and there's a big pool table. It smells a little like weed. And there's all model photos all over the wall. He's like, I think you probably want to work here. So I'm like, where are you?
More so than at the Wolf of Wall Street's place.
Yeah, no, I wasn't that. I couldn't take the Wolf of Wall Street place because those kids were kids who acted tough who I knew were wimpy, and just because they had money, it didn't mean
they had the bull midgets.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It didn't mean they could talk that way to me, at least. Right. You know. Yeah, so I wasn't down with that. But anyway. So I was like, where are you? And he goes, I'm at this magazine and blah, blah, blah. And it was some girl he was dating and worked, her friend worked there and he was going to pick her up or something like that. So I start harassing these people at this magazine. I'm like, I'm like, let me send you my portfolio. And at the time, my portfolio consisted of hand-drawn stuff. Like, you know, like I did flyers for clubs, or I did like a deli sign. I painted a sign for the deli, you know, like, or things like that, you know? And I did some, I had done some record album cover work or something like that, but hand-drawn stuff, like all hand-drawn and inked by hand, you know? And so I went in, so I kept harassing this one kid that they put me onto. And finally he's like, okay, come in. And I go in and he looks at my portfolio and goes, oh, it's pretty good. He goes, why don't you do me a favor? He's like, come by one day a week and you could be like a intern of some sort and everything. So the first day I'm there, I walked, like they sent me to go get some magazines to mail out to some people. And I see the publisher, the head guy, I hear him go to the editor in chief. I hear him go, who is that? So I said, oh, you know what? On my way back, I'm just going to walk in there and say hello. And I walk in and his name was Michael Bell'Uomo, which is beautiful man in Italian. And I walk in there and he's like, what's your name? I said, Tony Arcabashi. He goes, you Italian? I'm like, yeah, I'm Italian. And he goes, you speak Italian? I said, yeah, pretty good. And he goes, do you speak it or don't you speak it? I said, my parents are from Italy. I could speak it. So he goes, what are your intentions? And I said, I don't know. I was thinking about going back to school and learning how to use the computer. And I figured I could intern here and like learn in real life what, you know, this is where I want to be. So he goes, all right. He goes, do me a favor. He goes, don't go back to school. He goes, stay here, learn everything you can here, and I'll pay you what I can. And there I had. That was the start of my career.
What? You didn't say the magazine.
Sportswear International Magazine. It was a trade publication. It wasn't even like anything like, you know, Vogue, you know, thing, any of that type of shit. It was Sports and Time. And that's where I met my partners that I started A-Life with.
So was it an important experience because you met your partners? Did you learn anything about?
No, I learned everything. I learned everything because he was the type of boss that was just like, sit down, learn it. Oh, you need to shoot something? Go shoot it. You need to, you know, like, and it was like that. Oh, you want your friends to draw on the photographs or do this, that? Have them do it. You know, like he gave us free reign to do whatever we wanted, you know, and that's where we met all the people that we ended up working with all our lives, like photographers, stylists. Like we worked with big people back then because they weren't big yet, you know, and from those days we learned how to do all that stuff. And that's what gave us the balls to go out on our own. You know, we had made so many connects after 3 to 5 years of being there. And, you know, my partners were there actually even before me, the ones I started A-Life with. And so I was there from like 95 to 99. And then 99, one of my partners who was a writer, he left to go look for a space. And me and Rob were the art department. And he was like, me and Rob were like, you know what? Let's like keep our job so we could help fund this new project that we want to do. And then Arnaud having too much fun because he was like getting to look at spaces and getting the day, and we were getting jealous. So then me and Rob were like, you know what? We are going to give them an ultimatum. We're going to say double our salaries. And if they say yes, then we'll stay. If they say no, we'll walk. Of course they said no.
Well, that's, yeah. So,
but we just did it. We had nothing to lose at that point. We had nothing to lose. So we were like, we want you to. And
how did you dig up the money then? To start the business.
15 grand each. I had $15,000. I had $15,000, I think, from my paper route money from back when I was a kid. Yeah, and the dancing money.
You probably had every single penny.
I did. I still have my paper route shit. I swear to God. I think I had my bonds from my christening and shit. So I still had that. And then my partners maxed out their credit cards.
Yeah.
And that was it.
So that's how we started. You got a place.
We found a place, the cheapest place we could find, which is in the Lower East Side on Orchard Street. It was beat to shit. We had to redo the whole thing. We had to do all the electrical work, like redo. I mean, we redid everything.
And
yourselves?
No, I had my dad help me. And then, you know, other stuff, you know, we had to hire some people.
What was it like there? The area. Give us a feel for like what other businesses were around.
Yeah, it was like Russ and Daughters. It was mostly a nighttime place. During the day, it was more like fabrics and bootleg shit and things like that.
But you were
opening
a place for the day.
Yes, we were opening a place for the day, but we had this bright idea that we were going to stay open late and get the nighttime people.
Tell us what you were doing. I guess everybody knows A Life, but go back to the beginning. What was it? What was the mission?
So we didn't know what we wanted. We knew we wanted a space to do shit with all our friends that we made in these past, 5 to 10 years working in the magazine game, right? So we were like, okay, well, maybe we could do something where, me and Rob wanted to do like a creative agency, and Arnaud and his wife wanted to do more of like a retail shop, right? So we were like, okay, what are we going to sell? And Arnaud, his family came from the shoe business in Brazil and everything, the factories and all that shit. So we were like, okay, I want to do like a casual men's footwear store. And we were like, okay, that's a little too specific. Like, let's just do like that as a centerpiece, but then we'll just do like cool shit too, like things that we just like, And then we'll also have like a little creative agency so we could, while we're getting ourselves going, if we could try to get one account that could pay the bills, we'll do that, which we did. We got this one account designing a magazine. So we were doing that. And that was like, that helped us relax and helped us build the store out and do all that stuff, And we decided like, oh, fuck it. Like, let's just put shit that we love in here and create this lifestyle store that we'd want to shop in. And, there wasn't that many at the time, that was doing that. And then we were like, we're going to incorporate art. So like, we were like, we're going to have a gallery. We're going to have an event space. So we put everything on wheels so we could roll it all to the back and do events. We had a creative agency that was in a crow's nest that overlooked the store. So we were always had our ear on the street. Like, we knew everything that was going on. It wasn't like we had the agency in a separate place and the store in a separate place. It was one. So it became this like cultural hub for anybody and everybody that wanted to push their products, whether it was art or something they made, a toy that they made, and we were a consignment shop in the beginning, except for the footwear. Everything else was consignment.
So I hear that you were the first sort of sneaker shop around. Like, which is interesting. I mean, of course, sneakers existed. So, but to people that don't have a sense of what that was then, I mean, now sneakers are such like a trader's market and such a big business. That wasn't always the case, I guess.
I mean, I think at the Orchard spot, the first spot, when we started with just casual men's footwear, it didn't really involve sneakers. It was the only sneakers. It was like Camper, the Camper. Camper didn't exist. We brought Camper into the U.S. Like, then they opened up a store in Soho, but like, we were the first ones with Camper. Like, so that's what we were doing. We were getting shoes like Snipe, Dry Shot, Trickers, like all shit like that. Like, all like, casual men's footwear. And we decided one time to get some Converse sneakers and then have graffiti writers write on them. And all of a sudden, all these magazines started, taking photos of them and putting them in like, Time Out New York, like Gift Guide thing, like all shit like that, right? That was the first thing we were like, oh, sneakers. Like, that's what we all wear. Like, why are we not selling sneakers, But then at the time, there wasn't any unique or cool sneaker boutiques. It was Foot Locker and like Jimmy Jazz on like, Broadway or, on Delancey Street, a couple of shops, like, there really wasn't anything that was done well, at least, So we were like, one day we're hanging out and this guy walks in and he worked for Nike. And he was basically like, we see him looking around the shop and we were like, he looked a little suspect. And we were like, what's up? And he was like, can I come up and talk to you guys? Whatever. And he came up And he was like, boom, pulls out this Air Woven, which was the most unique sneaker we ever saw in our life. And he's like, we're just messing around with this prototype. He's like, I was thinking about telling, you know, everybody back at Nike, if maybe your store would be where we could launch this or something like that. You know, like, would you guys want to be the first store? Like, and we're like, fuck yeah, let's do this, you know? And at the time, they were like $500 sneakers. Like, that shit didn't exist, right? We sold out in the first day. And it was just word of mouth. There's no social fucking media back then. There's nothing. There's not even, we don't even have a website. I don't even think I had an email.
So Nike's trying this out as like, you're like the test case of this sneaker. If this goes in the coolest place downtown New York, then it's going to go everywhere.
Out of the whole world, we were chosen for this thing. And that's when we knew we have to open up a sneaker shop.
So, someone like Nike, they get to learn whether their shoe is cool and then how to market their shoe essentially for, you know, if New York was leading the way in a sense and A-Life was leading the way, then they could take that to the rest of the world, that idea. Yeah. So you were consultants for Nike at the same time as you were, you know, wholesalers or retail.
We never got paid anything from Nike except for the money we made off the shoes, like if they made special makeup.
That's a good gig for them.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with us was when we built this store, like I was saying before, we wanted to make the sneakers, the things that we wore that was part of our lifestyle and our part of our uniform. We wanted to shine a light on each shoe and create this beautiful fucking like showcase for them. So we had, I think 46 SKUs or 46 little pin light cubbies for just these shoes. And that was prime real estate. And Nike definitely wanted to take that over, you know, but we never let them. So our relationship with Nike throughout all those years, and I'm sure now with one of my partners who's still involved with it, even now to this day, was always a little bit like shaky because they, you know, Nike likes to come in and own you.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm always trying to figure out how to play around with brands, right? And big companies, like different corporations and sort of, you know, the culture of a founder and how that differs. And when you start to lose that and become a corporation.
I think what you're getting to is like how strategic partnerships are mutually beneficial too in a way. But it's like, I met Tony through his sister and the first time we went to A-Life together, me and Stephanie, she's like, come down here. And because I'd already been down a bunch and I'd hang around with my in the corner quietly watching like all the cool people like Q-Tip, like write on a little tile and hang it on the wall and like all the new art, just be like the young little kid and the quiet kid in the corner. And then
always dressed nicely.
Well, then it's in. Tony came and then like we got a tour of the Ribbon Club while I was in construction. There was this. He's like, this is this dumbwaiter. And it takes the shoes up from the basement to deliver you your size.
Yeah, like, we had came shit up special, that no one.
But he's like, this is going to be my art studio down there. And I feel like it quickly became storage. Yeah, and then, but once it was open, it wasn't the easiest place to get into. You'd have to ring a doorbell. And they'd look. And they'd be like, not cool enough. And they wouldn't open the door. So I'd have to go.
I would never be cool enough to get in there.
The corner and I'd be like, Tony, they're not letting me in the store. And then he'd call over them. And he's like, why aren't you letting him in the store? Let him in the store.
No, you know what it was? It was that New York mentality, man. I mean, you go into a lot of these young streetwear shops and the dirtbag off the street, the graffiti writer, the drug dealer, those guys got, you know, like... Those guys had more clout in there than if you were
dressed like Jimmy. How was Jimmy dressed? Nice, I mean, we got to paint the picture. Well, how was Jimmy dressed? Jimmy, and that's called streetwear back in 2001.
Jimmy came to town in like a Charles Dickens outfit, like you know. Like
so he was a streetwear out of Oliver Twist.
That's it. Three piece suit with a little short little tie and a pocket watch and shit. You know, but no, but.
He still had the dancing job.
Yeah.
I never had the dancing job.
No, but like, you know, like celebrities would come in there and they would get shitted on. Like my, you know, the skate kids that I had working in there or the graffiti writers that I had working there were not giving love to someone unless you were part of that inner circle, you know, and they made it tough for you. And, but it's very amusing because like you'd have these like fashion directors from Bloomingdale's or Jeffries or whatever, and they would come in and I feel like after a full day of bossing motherfuckers around, they wanted to be bossed around a little bit. So like they'd come in there and love it. They'd love that abuse a little bit. They'd love that they couldn't touch a sneaker and just had to look at it with their eyes. And they'd love that, like it was, I don't know, it was a weird dynamic.
Well, I was upstairs in the crow's nest once with you, and I was like, oh, this, I'm allowed up here with yeah. all these, like, these guys, and I'm just sitting on the couch with my little briefcase, like, because I skipped class that day, and all of a sudden someone comes in and is like, where's the super secret sneaker store? And he's like, who's that asshole? Well, tell that guy to fuck on. Then you look over and who was it?
No, I don't know. I'm not saying
Robin Williams.
Robin Williams.
But Robin Williams, actually.
But that time, that was the first time he stepped in and he came in looking. And then, yeah.
Robin Williams ended up being our best friend. Greatest guy in the world. Like, he would come
was
in.
Was he the kind of celebrity that wanted the sneakers for free so that he could wear them on a junket?
No, never. He bought the crazy, because he had I think, he had a young son. I don't know if he had more than one. But he would come in and buy stuff for himself, for his kids, for whatever. And he would come in and, like, he would buy markers. He'd buy, like, spray paint. He'd buy the craziest shit. Oh, and it was funny because in the beginning, he would come in and we would, you know, I would like go down and try to help him like or whatever because you know whatever I'm a fan you know and even though I'm for the most part not a star effort you know like him like he's just not he you know, he's on a different level you know so like I'd go down there and be like hey you know whatever and you know he was so quiet and timid and then once he started getting comfortable like the third time he was in there or the fourth his voices start coming out.
Was he as fast? I mean, was he as fast in real life?
Yep. And he would start saying like, oh, is my wife going to like me? I'm bringing home a marker. And he'd be like, he'd do his wife's voice. And then he'd be like a skit, you know? And I'd be like, okay, do I laugh? How do I react to this? But he was like that, you know? And he would make his rounds. He'd go to all the cool shops. You know, he'd go to the toy shop around the corner. He'd go to the other streetwear stores. He'd go to the thing. Yeah, he'd come in. He'd come in with all bags and he'd make his rounds like once a month and then and buy stuff for him and his friends and his kids and everything. Like when we would actually, when we first opened up the shop on Orchard Street, we'd fly to Japan and buy shit at retail. We didn't have the connections yet. We would just buy product at retail and bring it back to New York and just double it. That our wholesale was their retail, like, you know, like, because there was no way unless you came to our shop that you were going to get that.
Right. So, you know, yeah, you'd have your destination that day. I'm going to go. And the only place I can get this stuff is to go.
You couldn't get it. You couldn't buy anything online. Didn't even exist.
I think there's something to take about reminiscing that isn't just the kind of reactionary attitude, but you're looking back in order to look forward. In some ways.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, the work you do here, I even notice. I mean, you can talk about how you got into marketing, which is what you were doing at A-Life in a way, but in that was your own version of it. But how that becomes something of taking the things that you love from all over the place, feeling what that is a brand, but trying to make a life out of it. And that's why I like to be around you and Jimmy, is that, you know, what is the world we'd like to create together? At what point are you saying, do you ever say, I'm in a career now versus, you know, I'm building a business or I'm building this empire, this image, or is it just an evolution of the same thing?
I don't know. I think I was saying this to you the other night. Like, I spent like the first decade building my own brand, you know, or a little less than a decade. Then I spent a little more than a decade working for freelancing and working and building like I had a little, my own little agency, but like working for other brands. So my own brand and working for like multiple brands. And the only thing I didn't try was actually going to work for one brand, you know? And I remember Jimmy inviting me to the groundbreaking of Building 20. And I just looked at it and I just saw the potential of this great thing that you guys were doing, you know, like, and I had freelance, remember, it was like one, I think for like a month or so, like whatever, the year before. So I had an idea a little bit of what you guys are doing, and I loved everybody that was here. So it wasn't like a hard thing for me to transition into, but I just remember looking at Jimmy and being like, yo, give me a job, dude. Like, I just felt like it was time. I just felt like I was like, you know what? It's the only thing. It's that, like, it's like, you know, like that decade point again, where I was just like, I need that change. I need it. And I guess that's my clock, you know? And it was the greatest thing I ever did. I mean, coming with you guys, and I get to learn something totally new and apply the same marketing tactics that, you know, and I don't want to say it would be stale in the streetwear game or whatever, or this, that, because good design is good design and all that stuff. But there are things that I've done in the past that are maybe twisted or tweaked a little bit can be fresh in a new environment.
Oh my God. Anything you do is, you know, if it was in the past for somewhere else, you know, is 40, 50 years ahead of where anything in sort of, you know, science-y tech world gets.
It's,
even if we're doing, or our industry's doing, you know, things that influence people going forward, I was thinking about this, and I was talking to Jody, a mutual friend of ours, and he brought this up. He said, you know, during last April, during like the dark days of COVID, we were operating as an essential business, but you know, not everybody was coming to work. We had, you know, some people got to work from home because it was, you know, it was tough. We wanted to protect everybody. We wanted to make sure that, but we were an essential business because we were making things that had to do with, you know, COVID effort in a number of areas. And Jody reminds me, you know, Tony was there every day. And it wouldn't be the natural choice for people to think that the art director of our company would be essential. Until Jody said that, I said, oh my God, that's one of the most essential. If we don't have a way to give people hope that the science we're creating can help save them, if we don't do that for the world, then we have no way to be essential. And I realize this isn't just this isn't just a way to make me feel like I'm surrounded by beautiful, interesting, cool people and things. This is actually essential. It was pretty cool. It was great to share those dark moments with somebody, with both of you guys. I mean, we were in here, you know. Streets were empty.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Tony's like, can I come back to the office? I don't have to stay home, right? Can I come back? And I'm like, yeah, you can come and work. He's like,
yeah, I didn't know if I was allowed. I was like, really? I'm like, I can't work from home. Like, I'm not into that. I need to be like engulfed in an environment that I'm constantly being stimulated and learning shit. You know, if I want to work on a project, I need to be immersed in it. You know, like I need, so for me, not being around you guys, listening to your conversations, having Jimmy be like, hey, just read this, or go look at this site, or check this out, or look at this thing that we just made, or whatever. Like I needed that constant stimulation and inspiration to be able to understand. You know, that was like early on when I first started coming working for you guys. So like I still was figuring out how I could help, you know, and for me,
I'm still trying to figure out how I can. And I'm not joking. Yeah. I mean, I know that seems funny being that, you know, I found the company. I'm literally every day I try to figure that out. And I come into your offices and I see both of you, you guys have books stacked up that go, you know, everything from the Medicis to you know, scientific books about, you know, nanotechnology to Disney biographies. And they're all related to stuff that should inspire the work we're doing, and not in an abstract way. Then, you know, next thing I know, we're designing something for Disney, right? It's like, this is the kind of weird world we inhabit. So I'm trying to figure out from you what to do with my life.
No, and it's funny because people from my old game will be like, you're working at what? A nanotechnology company? My funny thing is yo, scientists need their shit to look sexy too.
Yeah. You know, all the more we need it sexier. We've got a long way to go. We have to work harder for it. No,
but it's funny, but you know, at the end of the day, even like, you know, I was forced to learn PowerPoint. You know, I never did that shit.
Yeah. So you're not afraid. You don't seem afraid of much. Like, you're not afraid of, you know, the internet or COVID destroying neighborhoods, even though you've cared about that. You're not afraid of China being great, you know, great at things that America or Italy were prized great at. How do you feel about the fact that you work in a company that makes artificial intelligence and, you know, things that traditionally humans were good at? Do you feel challenged by the artificial?
No. I don't know why I don't.
By machines?
I don't know why I don't. Maybe I'm naive or I have no idea. But like, for me, I just feel like this is progression, right? And we have to adapt to it. I don't know any other way. And it really is, again, going back to the New York way. Like, that's how I feel. Like, I don't know. I'm not fearful of any of that. I feel like I've always been on to the next.
Has anything excited you about? I mean, so I bring this up because you really, the two brands that I've heard you talk about are for most people who aren't as cool as you, obvious. But for you, it almost surprises me because it's so obvious, which are, you know, Apple and Disney. These are like two international brands, but just Disney. Tell me about it. No, seriously. I mean, you don't have to. What the reason why? I mean, and it comes after this artificial intelligence comment because there's something that is next about it, right? Especially if what we're talking about is sort of Epcot and, you know, or Disney himself trying to think, what is the next thing that is, I wouldn't say post human, but post who we are now. Does that affect your work at all?
I mean,
or is it just cool and fun? No, is it just interesting design?
No, I think that the way he thought it inspires me. That's why I've studied up on him and just the way even I'm reading right now, Disney way of marketing, like, you know, just whatever. Like I love that he was that guy. You know, there was this dynamic between him and his brother. And his brother was the guy that would try to pull him back, you know, and he was the guy that was always like, no, fuck that. We're going to spend every dollar we got and we're going to try to do this and we're going to try to make this and we're going to try to go forward and we're going to try to make this world of tomorrow. And we're going to. But he was smart in every way that he did that. You know, he involved the right partners all the time. He used other people's money to experiment with before he threw his own money in there, like with all the World's Fair stuff and everything.
Unlike A-Life.
Right. Unlike A-Life. And that's why
I think... Or Nanotronics, for that matter. We started pulling in other people's money after I learned that. After.
No, it's 100% true. Like, we wouldn't even... At A-Life, we wouldn't even take free beer or free things at our events from other companies because we didn't want to put their branding up. Right. Like, we were just like, fuck everybody, it's us. But, you know, that's not the smart way.
It's cool. There's not that one safe.
It's nice. It's respectable. It's respectable. Don't get me wrong. We would never, no one ever said, oh shit, you sold out, Tone, or whatever. They're like, no. But like, because, and I didn't have to worry about that. But as I get older, I realize how to use resources and how to be smart about shit. You know, like for me, Disney was that, you know, and he was, and he definitely was. I mean, the whole Epcot thing was, you know, that it came nowhere near what he wanted to do. He died before any of that shit happened, you know, but his idea was to build this fucking creative environment, neighborhood, community, you know, that was going to be as safe as anything in the world, with cars running underneath the ground and people movers and monorails and this, the way it was set up in this circular fashion. I mean, he was thinking so ahead of his time, you know, and I love that about that, you know, and I love that he's all about the experience. It's so ironic because I'm reading all these books on him and everything. And I see how that he actually, it's all about the customer. Whereas in New York and retail, it's like, it really, when we were coming up, it really wasn't about the customer. It really wasn't. It was almost like it was a New York attitude that attracted the customer, which was that tough, cool guy shit, you know? But it wasn't about being so fucking there for them, you know what I'm saying? Whereas in Disney, it's all about that. I mean, there is no room for, I mean, if you're the guy that's cleaning the toilet and someone says, can you help me get on the ride? They're supposed to stop and help you get on the ride. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's just a whole different way of thinking. And I think that's where we are in life now. I think that people really have to go out of their way to keep customers. I think that the environment is different. I think that we really, really, it's all about customer service nowadays.
Really? God, I didn't think that's where you were going with it. I thought that no. You were going to, you're actually a utopian like we are after all. Oh. But that's interesting. I mean, so I guess who we've become as humans is being able to take care of each other.
That's it.
You could have all of this. You can envision this incredibly cool technology and beautiful. You can market it well. You can do all of the things that Disney did. You could be and you could be cool the way you all have been. But what we have for each other is each other.
No, and that's
as humans.
And we need each other now.
We need each other now.
You know, this is at any point right now, it is now that we need that. Like, you know, we need that love for each other, country, race, this, that shit, it has to all go to the wayside. Like this is all about that. It's all about, and I think that's where business is going as well. You know, I don't think that there's any room for that cool guy shit anymore. I really don't. I think it's all about that now.
Well, Tony, I still think you're a cool guy and there's room for you around here.
No, I get that. I understand that and I appreciate that. But I just, I love having this family here at Natotronics. I was on my own for so long, you know, and I was working with great people in all different brands and all different points of, you know, all over the earth. You know what I'm saying? And I loved all that. But there was something about coming here and seeing what you guys do, and you're doing something good, you know, and everybody's like a family here. And I was missing that, you know, and I think that especially during this year of COVID, like that helped me move forward, you know. And I think that's why I'm even talking about this, a whole new way of marketing that I'm saying, like the Disney way or whatever way, you know. It's like, it just really feels like, yo, we fucking need to all be a team, you know, just to move forward.
The previous business, Tech Pro, when I came into this business, my father had started, and my parents actually both worked there. And then I ran it with my father, and my cousin was involved with family business that grew. And when I came in, I grew the international business. And one thing, and it was sort of a precursor of Nanotronics, was a Swedish company called Optronics that we acquired. And they made this optical inspection. And they were a part of, right in the middle of the acquisition, they were already part of a 3-year project to make what's called the green tire. So this was oh god, early 2000s, very early 2000s, and you know, it was early environmental movement, and Europe was way ahead of the United States, and it was to make sure that, you know, a tire, which is, you know, it's petroleum, it's something called carbon black, it's a real messy thing, it's just to make an environmentally friendly tire. They were part of this multi-nation thing. Every country got two delegates, and it was in it, only Europeans. Now, no Americans, God forbid. And I got kind of this company was grandfathered into it, and I wanted the seat. So you'd go around to these countries, and I would be the delegate from Sweden, and like there would always be the Swedish flag on my thing, you know. And I'm in France, and the minister of economy for France greets. Decided he's going to greet everybody in their home language, and he greets me in Swedish. I don't know anything, so I just said bonjour. You know, like I couldn't deal with it. But yeah, so listen, you know, I'm Swedish by acquisition,
right?
But other than that, I also have had just I like Sweden for a number of reasons, but so you've worked in Sweden.
For years for multiple brands, but like the biggest ones were WSC, which is like was a streetwear brand that was created in Sweden, but grew on the West Coast here in California. And then, so I used to go there a few times a year just for that. And I worked there for years and years. I spent a year working right before I came here for Volvo and this new project they were doing, which was called Link & Co. And that was like this new car sharing, electric car, the whole thing that I was involved with launching. And I just love that everybody there, even though I'm a workaholic and that's usually the entrepreneurial way, I love that these people, it's family and fun first and work last.
Really, that's Northern Europe. I'm surprised. That should be the Italian.
These guys at 4 o'clock, they were already packing their fucking bags up, like waiting for like that Flintstone bell to hit.
Oh, you know, God, like, I had a different experience than that. That's
No. And it was just, they just were always happy. And yes, it's dark. It's dark. I had a different experience.
Man, you had a different experience.
These guys were, yeah, it was dark like half the year or whatever and everything. But they were just always about, like, it was more about taking time off, spending time with family.
No shit.
Yeah, I must have had a totally different experience.
No, I didn't have a totally different experience. Although I have to cut in. You work for Volvo. Did you ever hear about the Moose test?
No.
So my Swedish friends, like the closest friends to my family are a Swedish couple. And so, you know, I grew up with, you know, hanging around these Swedish people. And they were so proud that, you know, I would say, oh, you know, look, I'm going to get a BMW. And they said, BMW, it's a terrible car. What are you talking about? It's a terrible car. Fails the Moose test. Apparently, they have a certification for cars in Sweden. I don't know if this is true, but this is what I heard back then, where your car has to be able to swerve fast enough to not hit a moose if it crosses the street.
I don't know about that.
As good as German engineering may be, the Volvo would pass it, but not the
Is this
BMW.
The Dudley Moore crazy people version of they're boxy, but they're good?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yes. It's the Moose test, though.
But it's that's so funny. The Moose test. I mean, but here you are 20 years after Matthew's working on it. But it's still, how can we improve the experience of the automobile to deal with something everyone cares about in this climate change situation? But is it really climate change or just making better things that are safer and with new materials? Because it's like, it's not really a climate change thing. It's like, how do we use this thing that we love, this automobile, to use new materials? So it's
They were always a step ahead for that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. Whether it is better, is the healthcare system better because, you know, they were innovators? Were they thinking a step ahead? Is their education system better? Is there sexual liberation, which was far ahead of ours? I mean, there are all these things. I don't think the Swedes are perfect in any way, but it's really interesting to think of it this way.
But it's also really interesting to think about what was the Optigrator and then the Dispergrator, and I don't know whatever it was called after the acquisition, but it wasn't for tires even originally, right?
It was no, it's for dental.
It was for dental stuff. So the same tool that could be used to create a measurement of your teeth in a couple of dimensions work just as well for rubber and tires. And like, how do we transfer those things? I mean, the first thing I learned from Matthew, the first week at Nanotronics, I became obsessed with rolling resistance of a tire.
Yeah, who isn't?
But it was like, you know, it's like, okay, the rolling resistance and what it means. And then you start thinking about air pressure, and then you start thinking about how much, you know, fuel you're using. And then you start really thinking about, all right, how do we build roads differently? And then you start thinking about, like, what are the material? And then you start thinking about how the entire experience of a like a city works, just based on how the rolling resistance of a tire may be and like what that provides. And I feel you think that way, Tony. And I think Matthew has always thought that way from what I understand. And that you're always trying to both, and then you've both been such great mentors to me because you encourage me to connect more dots. And I feel that I get to.
Oh, no, you're a great systems thinker, well, Jimmy. I mean, like, you and Jesus. Yeah,
but for both of you, that I get to be the.
I'm not even close to being the thinker that you are.
I get to be the feeder of it. I feel like the librarian who's like, try these books too. Like, you're like, oh, you came for this, but like both of you, I'm like, oh, no, try these. Like, so like, you're like the. Like if I was like the old librarian and you're the, like the kids coming, like the eager, curious kids, I was like, I got a special 10 books stacked away for you. Take these home. Don't tell your mom. Like, they're on my cart, you know, but I don't feel anymore that I'm the feeder of the information as much as you're both the, like, can put it out into the world.
I don't think that's true, but you do. But there is something that you're creating laboratories. And if you think of the whole country of Sweden as a laboratory, or you think of what you had said early about your first shop, it's like you and I joked around that you couldn't have made a Silicon Valley pitch, but it wasn't exactly a joke. Silicon Valley wants you to have the end market that they want you to have, where you'll have hockey stick growth in this particular niche that ends up doing this and doing that. No, you created a laboratory for what you were doing. Is Sweden a laboratory? Is Building 20 a laboratory for discovery? You know, these things, then you may step back in the end, hopefully, and say, oh, were they trying to, you know, save the environment from climate change? Or were they, you know, trying to make sure that the next pandemic didn't come? And maybe that wasn't it all the time. Maybe it was this experimenting with things that are cool, interesting. I don't know. Does that ever cross your mind, Tony?
For me, you guys are talking definitely a different way that I experienced all that. Like, for me, Sweden, the reason I loved Sweden was strictly the family aspect of it. You know, it wasn't about any of these industries or this or that a thing. Like, for me, what I loved about working there, and what I loved that family came first. I loved that they seemed to me stress-free, because I guess whatever it is, socialist, this, that, whatever, they weren't paying for school. They weren't paying for health. They weren't paying for things. It was all about go to work, come home, do, like, you know, hang out with their family, enjoy the time with each other, drink some wine, do the thing. Like, I love that mentality. And maybe I hung out with like the younger kids more, because I was basically worked with more of a streetwear brand. I just loved the way that they lived their life like that.
Were they proud of their work?
I don't know, because it was never this. Of course they were proud of their work. You know, like, but it was not priority number one.
It's against
the way I am. Like I invest everything into what I'm doing, you know? And sometimes it would frustrate me. That would frustrate me a little bit. But then I saw them just like fucking embracing like their time off with all their rules where they have paternal leave and fucking 1 year off vacations and sabbaticals.
Yeah, silly sweets. Never mind. I'm done with that. But you know, what's the strangest thing of hearing
you? Is that
you
a bad way to live? I don't know.
Nah, but check this out, Tony. What I hear is like, take the name of the country away. What I hear is Italians.
I mean seriously.
This is a Mediterranean thing.
For real.
And
I'm
gonna be the psychoanalyst for 1 minute of this thing.
I guess you're right.
Say,
I guess
you're
right.
Talking about your family and what your or at least your family ideal of what your Italian, that's the way Italians are.
Right,
they care about their life
like
and their craft.
That's what I'm saying. I didn't grow up like that. Like my father worked his fucking ass off. He always had his own
ass
business.
Off too.
What?
Yeah.
You know, he always had his own business. He
so did
always
Ferragamo.
So that's what I'm saying. I didn't experience that siesta in the middle of fucking the day, like they have actually in Italy, like where stores close down and shit like
yes,
that.
Yes, but they don't have that in Stockholm.
No, they don't have that in Stockholm, but they have it in another way.
I think people were like, oh, Jimmy, you're so obsessed with history and you like to talk about this and you talk about this. And we're like, well, when we were talking about building 20, what we're building here, there was a model and it started in 1837 and it started with the Erie Canal and started with this. And yes, there's a provenance and there's this history, but what I'm really trying to push, and maybe I'm going to give some tricks away in my own thinking, is that that was the first mover. So we get to be successful by not being the first mover. And then it can propagate around the world. And Tony, unfortunately, with A-Life was the first mover. And so then you had all these other copycats or people that were inspired by you or things that became billion-dollar companies and super successful and off of that. And you guys did all the hard work, but you also inspired everybody. And I think when I sometimes talk about history, I'm like trying to be like, well, we're not the first mover. We're not an early adopter. We're just improving on something. And I know you recently said all of a sudden there's these people asking about documentaries and podcasts and they're mentioning us and all these big brands and all these other companies. Be like, all of a sudden it's like these kids were so influenced by what I did in 1999. And I know I was. I just started college and I was like scared of this guy. And he was a mentor and one of like five of the most important mentors for me at the time who made me who I am now today. But when is something a laboratory and can still be the thing that succeeds and not the stepping stone for something else?
It's you have to figure that out, you know, and it's on an individual basis. Like for us, you know, people didn't want us to capitalize on anything that we created. They didn't want that from A-Life. What they wanted from A-Life was the next big thing. And that's all they wanted. You know, it was the Urban Outfitters and fucking shit like that that would come and be able to produce something that was handmade by an artisan and that we were selling on consignment. And they could take it. I mean, I knew people that worked at certain companies and they'd be like, yo, your shit is on an inspiration board right now. And we're about to make it in 2 weeks and it's going to be everywhere, you know? And that's not what people wanted from A-Life. They wanted the next fucking thing. They wanted always us to be on to the next. So that's one of the reasons why we never really capitalized or I don't want to say, at least when I was there, we weren't able to fucking really like grow bigger than we were trying to get. You know, it just wasn't something that people wanted from us. They didn't want that. They wanted the next thing. They would come in. We had people coming in regularly because they knew every week we'd have fresh new product, fresh new stuff, the next hot shit, you know? And we weren't able to capitalize on that. Now, I think that sucks, you know? And I think that maybe we didn't figure out how to do that, you know? At least, like I said, when I was there. But, you know, I don't know.
You know, it's feasible that Jimmy's right that it's just not the way things work, and that it's really frustrating that if we try to think about success, we have to say, oh, I promise we're not fully innovating here. Somebody else has done this and we're building off of this. Because if we do fully innovate, it's a recipe for not being the richest, the biggest, and that's the push and pull of it in a weird way. That history will look back and romanticize the first mover. But
it also gives you a little bit of longevity too, being the innovator of something, even if you weren't able to capitalize on it, the people in the game, they sort of fucking know.
Maybe that's
and you get that respect. You may not get the money that came with it, but you get the respect. You know, I hear that a lot from people in the industry, like, oh, you guys were the first this, or you guys remember when you did that, or whatever. And I hear that. Did it translate into, you know, more than that? No, but you'll always have that respect. And the last standing of these sneaker boutiques is still fucking the Rivington Club. It's still there. You know what I'm saying? It's still fucking there. You know, it's like
even though it was the only thing that was looted in 2013. Yeah,
that was the only thing. That was the only store looted during the blackout
in 2013.
That says something.
The first blackout, TVs. Second blackout, sneakers. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like back in whatever, the first blackout was like in the 70s or whatever. Remember, everybody was robbing fucking TVs. Yeah,
77, John Lindsay.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, that's just how it is. So I'm okay with that. You know, I live okay. I have a great place. I ended up in a great place. And for me, the respect is good enough. You know, and I always like to work like that. You know, like I always, as long as there's respect in the game, there's nothing better than that.
Well, man, I feel so lucky to work with you. Man, let's build the next thing together. Thank you. Thanks, Jimmy.